Welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is our third series of episodes. This is on the war in Vietnam. And we're talking to vets. We're talking to just all kinds of every angle that we can get. We're even talking to a person. We've even talked to a person who lives in Ho Chi Minh City right now and has been there for 14 years. The purpose of these episodes is more to get the personal approach. This is not a political agenda at all. And so with that in mind, first of all, I want to give a shout out to my good friend and neighbor, Max Clevenger, who flew for three tours in Vietnam. And he flew C-130s, and he did over 2,500 sorties in Vietnam, primarily from Khe Sanh to Saigon and around in that area. And today, I really feel privileged to have with me Bob Barnett, or Colonel Barnett, and his daughter is also with us today. And Colonel Barnett was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for almost 7 years. And his daughter, Lori, when Bob left to go to Vietnam, was 7 years old. So we're going to do the first half of our program with Bob and the second half with Lori with comments from Bob. So, Bob, tell me about what you're doing right now. I need to know what retirement's going to be like a little bit.
Retirement is wonderful.
Good.
Right at the moment, I'm sitting in Tucson. It's 83 degrees. The sun's out. We're living a beautiful little house. And Suzanne and I, my fiance, we travel. We were doing extensive travel until the COVID came along.
Right.
But she has a house in Fort Worth, and I have one here in Tucson. So we go back and forth, and have lots of friends. And we're going to have a POW reunion in June in Colorado Springs. These are NAMPOW POWs.
Uh-huh.
And there's about 415 of us left alive from the POW camps in Vietnam.
And there were about 16. How many were there that came out of?
There were a total of, probably counting civilians, almost 700.
Wow.
Military-wise, there's about 600.
Wow. So to have that many alive actually is pretty good with with Agent Orange and all those kinds of things. I know that's what my my friend tells me about, that he has some issues with that.
Yeah, well, a lot of us flew out of Thailand. I was in Thailand and bombing in North Vietnam. Most of the pilots that were in Vietnam were not we weren't in South Vietnam, so Agent Orange wasn't a problem. But
right, and of course,
the AAAs and the SAMs and the MiGs were the problems.
Right. Yeah, that's, I can understand that. Let's talk a little bit about this. Your only daughter, Lori, was seven.
Yes.
And she explained to me a little bit, but tell the audience, that you had moved to California and about that time before you went over there. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, my Air Force career, Lori was born when I was in Iceland, and I came home, and we were in Luke Air Force Base for a few years, and then in California, and then we had a two-year tour in South America and Ecuador, and she was there she learned to speak Spanish and still does.
That's and good. That's a great skill to have.
So when we came back from Ecuador, I went to Colorado Springs, and then I went to Vietnam. So she went to three first grades when she was, what, 5 or 6 years old. Anyway, I went off to Vietnam and left my wife and Lori in Los Angeles area in Hawthorne, California. My mother and dad lived there, and her and my wife Anita, who is deceased, lived there. Their parents lived there. My brother, sister-in-law lived there. My sister lived there. So she had a lot of support. So when I left, and I was planning on going and flying my 100 missions, which was going to take about 7-8 months, and didn't work out that way.
Right.
So I left them in a little apartment, and they stayed in that apartment. Actually, I wasn't 7 years of POW. I was 5.5 years.
Okay.
And, yeah. And so they stayed in that, but I was gone about 6 years when you...
Right.
All that stuff. So anyway, I left them in a little apartment there, and my wife took good care of her, and my... father-in-law passed away about 7 months after I was gone. So lots of things happened.
Sure. What were your, when you knew you were going to Vietnam, that you were going to be flying the, and you flew the Thud, correct?
Yes, I flew the F-105 Thunder Chief, nicknamed the Thud. Yeah.
Okay. And, what were your expectations? Was it something you were concerned about? Did you have any idea what you were going to be doing when you got over there? You said,
well, yeah,
you knew the number of missions.
Yeah, well, I knew exactly what my goals were, because we went through training for about 6 months before we went there. And when I got there, the goal was to make 100 missions, and then you finish your tour and you come home. And I volunteered to do that, so I have no compunctions about whatever happened after that.
Right. I mean, that's what I hear from so many veterans that we talk to, is I was over there to do a job, and, very matter-of-factly. And I knew what I was doing, and didn't always know where I was. Sometimes they said that.
I knew where I was. I'd been in the Air Force for 14 years, and I had over 4,000 hours of flying time at that point. And so I'd been around enough to know what was going on.
And these were primarily bombing missions that you were on, is that correct?
Our mission was to cut off the supplies and so forth coming from north down south. And all my missions were into North Vietnam. Oh. And it was divided in different packs. The pack one was in the lower part of, right on the border between South Vietnam and North Vietnam. And we did a lot of bombing in there. And then, of course, we went up to, we had 25 missions up to the Hanoi area before I got shot down.
Were these, were a lot of these missions along the Ho Chi Minh Trail? Or?
So, the ones in pack one, we had some along there. But our primary mission was bombing up in what we call Pac-6 around Hanoi.
Uh-huh. And so up there you would be looking for military installations.
Bridges, railroad yards, highways.
Anything to mess up transportation and
fuel,
infrastructure.
Areas, air bases. I bombed a Kep Air Base a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And Phuc Yen was another base. When I first got there, we were very limited on what we could bomb and what we couldn't bomb. And one was Phuc Yen is a big MiG base, and we couldn't bomb that.
Uh-huh.
But I bombed their barracks buildings one time, and I bombed the entryway into the base, but we couldn't bomb where all the airplanes were.
You know, I said I wouldn't get political, but this is the only political question that I have, because I've heard this from so many of the vets that I've interviewed. And they have said, and you can just tell me if you agree with me or not, they have said they wish that they had let the military run the war instead of the politicians.
Well, that's true. President Johnson was picking the targets. And they were afraid of if we bombed all these bases, the MiGs would go up into China, and then we'd get mixed up with China, and they didn't want a bigger war. And so I think they're very hesitant. They thought that the bombing, if we did enough of it, they would have finally agreed a truce. But we never bombed them enough to do that. So
yeah.
So it was a lot of, you know, everybody second-guessed. When it come to Iraq, they learned a lesson, and you can see what they did in Iraq. That was amazing what they did there.
Yeah. And that's really, really interesting because, you know, even some of the vets I talked to were working along the Mekong, and there'd be a ceasefire, and they weren't supposed to fire on any of the sandpans or anything, but yet the transportation of sandpans up and down the Mekong increased almost tenfold, and they knew that they were carrying, you know, ordnance and supplies. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about the time that you were shot down and what happened, and you know, being on the ground and.
Okay, well, it's a long story. I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
Anyway, I was on my 43rd mission, and we were bombing a pontoon bridge just northeast of Hanoi. I'd bombed that on my sixth mission when it was a bridge, and now we were going back to, they put a pontoon bridge up there. And we flew, a formation of four airplanes in a formation, and we would have 16 105 bombers plus four Weasel flights would be out in front of our force to take the SAMs down. And so anyway, we went up across Vietnam and up the Gulf of Tonkin, refueled with the tankers, and then went inbound just north of Haiphong directly in towards the target. And there was MiG calls, and as we got next, I was leading a flight of four of the 16 airplanes. And as we approached the target, I was just about a minute, and I was going to about ready to roll in, and they fired SAMs at it, and we heard SAM, and I was looking for the SAM, but I didn't see it. And the next thing, it blew up right behind my airplane, and I had fire lights, and I turned, and my flight went with me, and I turned outbound, trying to make it back out to the ocean. And as I rolled out, my hydraulic system went out, so I had a system in the airplane where I could lock the stab and at least fly the airplane until I got out of the Hanoi area. So as I got out towards the water, I had an oil light come on, and then the engine failed, and so I was forced to eject. I was doing about 360 knots at 16,000 feet. And as I went out, my little boat that you sit on inflated before the parachute. So the boat went out, and then the parachute came out and wrapped around the boat. So I had kind of a streamer at first, like, figured I wasn't too good. So anyway, I came down, and as I was coming down, the parachute opened up a little bit. And I went flying through a bunch of trees and ricocheted into a bush and knocked the wind out of me. And I was in pretty good shape to get picked up. But the fickle finger of fate, a Navy pilot was shot down at the same time I was in Haiphong Harbor. So the rescue airplane, Navy, went and picked up a Navy guy, and they didn't have enough gas to come pick me up. So I spent the night out there, and then the next day, I almost got captured several times, and they tried to pick me up with a helicopter. The helicopter was hit by ground fire, and they made it out to the water. And I was out two nights, and then on the third day, they tracked me down with a dog. And
so they knew you were out there someplace.
Oh yeah, they were all looking for me. And I almost got captured several times, but I was under a bush when the dog came in, and there was about 12 people in the group. About six of them had loincloths on. That's how primitive it is. So I went into a little village, and they kept me there that night, and they worked me over in the morning. Then they tried to use me as a decoy, and I was able to foil that.
Helicopter to come down?
Because they sent the whole force in to try to save me that next day. They didn't know I'd been captured. And I was able to make false calls. So the force recognized that I had been captured, and the rescue attempt ended. So I was taken into Hanoi on a truck in the middle of the night on the gas tank, tied up, taken right into the interrogation. I spent 6 or 7 days, intense interrogation, being put in the ropes. And once they got through with that, I went into solitary confinement. And I stayed there for about a month or so in the Hanoi Hilton. Then I was moved out to a new camp, or a new area of a camp called the Zoo. And I spent 3 years out there.
And that was outside of Hanoi, wasn't it?
It was about 11 miles south-southeast of Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
It had been a French photo factory or something, and they made it into a prison. They kept about 115 of us there in that camp.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of the time I was in a small two-man cell. And it wasn't very nice.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't very nice. What were your thoughts? What were your thoughts at that time? Do you think you were going to make it out of there?
Yeah, I had a 3-month plan. I figured if I can just last 3 more months, I could make it. And then I kept thinking the war was going to end, and it went on and on and on. But I think that was the main thing. And then, of course, my cellmates, very supportive. We had great Americans were my cellmates, and I don't know any of them that didn't resist as much as they possibly could. We wanted to come home with honor, and I think at least all the ones I knew came home with honor.
That's good. Let me ask you something else. This is a more of a logistical question. My friend who came over to my house Sunday and showed me his slides from Vietnam, and they were dropping daisy cutters and all kinds of crazy things. But the nice thing about the C-130, of course, was it was so they could use it for medevac or troops.
Right,
or,
very, very versatile.
Yeah. And he actually came over to my house in his flight uniform that he wore in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And he also wanted to kind of explain that to me. And I don't know if yours was like this, but he had, like if he was to be captured, he had like these almost like Velcro things where he would pull off that would have his rank or, identifying information.
Right, yeah, that's what we had with, you had a little symbol with your squadron on it and your name, and it was all Velcro, right, yeah.
Right. And then he said, this is what saved me one time. And in a zippered pocket on his leg, he had kind of a knife.
Yeah, we carried a knife.
Uh-huh. It was an orange, kind of an orange-colored knife. But it was also to cut some of the lines on the parachute or something so you had more control over the parachute.
That's what I did when my parachute was all snagged. I took my knife out, and all I could do is just cut the parachute off.
Yeah.
So in my case, I couldn't, but I did have the idea I was going to try to cut some lines, but I couldn't do it. It was all tangled up.
And he said also that the first thing that they did was usually, you know, take all your clothes off. So if
they did,
they
give me some little blue shorts.
Uh huh. That if you had to, blue is a good color, but maybe not in that situation.
Well, they seem to like blue ones.
Yeah. And he also said with this knife that was the one that if you had your clothes taken off, that you hid that kind of in any body orifice that you could. Whatever you had to do.
In my case, I didn't have that choice. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so then you must have had, you know, a lot of times we were talking earlier that when someone is in the hospital, you're out of the hospital, sometimes it's harder for the person, you know, who is out kind of wondering what was going on. Were you able to have any communication with your family? Did your family know that you were alive? Did they, what was the status there?
Well, they didn't release my name, and I was MIA for 2.5 years. And Ho Chi Minh died in 1969, and once he passed away, I think enough pressure from the families and people in the United States, they changed a lot of their, we didn't have to bow to him after that, after Ho Chi Minh died, and they came around and for the first time offered me the opportunity to write a letter without any strings attached. If I had written any letters before, I had to make some kind of a tape or signed statements or something. I never did that. So anyway, I was at the time I was living with four Navy pilots, another Air Force pilot. None of us had ever written, and we're all MIA. So once we were assured that there was no strings attached, we wrote these six-line letters, and I think it was on Good Friday or Easter, I think. Well, there was some communist anti-war people that came to Hanoi, and they took our little letters and take them home and put their propaganda in it and sent it to our families. That was my first letter, the first letter uh-huh. that my uh-huh. wife got. And of course, then the military realized, and my status changed from missing in action to captured. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, we were able to write letters every so often, although I didn't get a letter for the 3 years when they gave me the first letter. And the first letter my wife had written to me, and she said, I didn't know whether you're dead or alive, and I don't know what to do with my life and all this stuff.
That must have been pretty hard to take.
And I thought by that time she had at least gotten some word. I didn't know that she had gotten the word, but this is the letter they gave me. They're really nice people, you know.
Yes. So, yes. I also noticed when I was reading this Veterans Tribute to you that if we had done this last Saturday or earlier in the week, it was October 3rd that when you were forced to eject over...
That's correct. Yeah. October 3rd, 1967, and I was released on March 14th, 1973.
Can you tell me kind of what, was every day different when you were there? Was it boring? Were there things that were unexpected? I don't know if that's a good question.
It's hard to say. You know, first you're by yourself and you wonder, what the hell did I do to deserve this?
Yeah.
And then I got moved in. I got moved in with three other pilots, and two of them I had known before. That's a small world. And they got shot down after I did. And one of them had been there for about 14 weeks, and I was surprised he was still alive. That's the way I felt. And sure. We had moved in this camp called the Zoo, and the Zoo Annex, and We were in a pretty large cell, but there was no windows or couldn't see out, and we didn't know where we were. We had no contact with anybody. So we were there for about 6 months before we made any contact. And I had, there was a thing called the TAPCO that you could tap on the wall and communicate with people. And none of us had heard of it. And finally, I had a cellmate moved in. He had heard about it, so we took some brick and wrote on the floor and started pounding on the wall next to the cell, and we finally made some contact with some people.
You know, it's interesting. I find that talking to a lot of the veterans, they were pretty darn creative, you know.
It's amazing the talent that was in this group. When we later, they had a raid at a place called Sante where they tried to take some prisoners out in November of 1970. And after that, they moved all the POWs they had into the Hanoi Hilton into big cells. So we were in big cells, and the cell I was in had 26 people in it. And we started teaching classes and all kind. I had a little Spanish group because I could speak Spanish, and people that had, you know, they're just amazing, the talent in the groups.
And I think it's also, you know, whether it's, even when you talk about physical health, so much of it is mental.
Oh, yeah.
And I know, just in my own personal case, with COVID, I tend to be a pretty active, I use a wheelchair for mobility, but I tend to be pretty active and get around and do what I want to do.
Right, yeah.
Fish whatever. And when COVID came around, I just kind of went stir crazy. I, you know, I needed something to do. And so I, you know, got started on this project. And it's kind of been a lifesaver for me. And I'm sure for the, I mean, I can't answer for you, but I'm sure at least with the inmates that were there, you know, having those classes to take at least occupied your mind other than thinking, you know, totally negative thoughts all the time.
Well, you know, and by tapping on the wall, and it's amazing the coincidences, you know, it's a very small fraternity of the pilots, and so somebody knows somebody that knows somebody, and we all had, most of us were college graduates and had been all over the world, and
sure.
But the thing of it is, they gave us, for the first 3 or 4 years, we had no reading material, nothing. So when I was spent probably a year and a half with another POW named Dwight Sullivan, he and I would walk around in circles for hours. We'd try to think of the capitals of every state and every country, and then we tapped on the wall and we got the names of everybody in the camp and where they were. And this was tapping on the wall and communicating was very dangerous, because if they ever caught you, you would be in for some very, very bad treatment. And but we were very tricky, and so we never got caught, but a lot of people did.
Did you tap like letters? Is that what you did?
There's a book. Smitty Harris was a POW that came in 1965 with the first, and he'd been gone through a survival school, and he had heard that they had a tap code in World War II, and he had stopped and learned that, so he brought it in. And it's a matrix of 25 letters. If you just take a square and do vertical lines and horizontal lines, and A is 1-1, B is 1-2, 3 is 1, or C is 1-3. You know. So anyway, because the Morse code didn't work well as far as tapping on the walls,
and if you could tap, you know, I thought, you know, this is just my poor sense of humor, but I was thinking if you could tap the word dance, you could actually tap dance.
Do what now?
Oh, that was bad. I know.
Say that one again. Yeah. It probably was really funny.
Well, maybe it was. I just said, I said, if you could use your tap code and tap the word dance,
yeah,
then everybody there could be tap. They could tap dance. You know, another skill.
That wasn't too bad.
I bet you that would have been a picture of a 26. Yeah. 26 of you there in the cell at the same time tap dancing. But I'd like you to tell me a little bit about the Friday pilots.
Oh, okay.
Lori told me a little bit about that. Let's talk about that, and then let's bring Lori in here and get her voice. And I also want to say Bob, that your daughter contacted me, and I really appreciate that. I think it really shows to me that she wanted this story to be here, and it just tells me how much she cares about you and loves you, and so I think that's a real positive. So,
well, she's been a great mom, and she has four of the greatest kids. And it's
I'm sorry, those are my grandchildren.
And in this day and age, when so many of them get in trouble and have all kinds of things, they've done so well. And Tim, her husband, is just a wonderful guy.
Well,
and when my wife passed away, and Suzanne and I got together, both of them accepted her just as part of the family, and she's, you know, she had her time too. Her husband had fallen down and broken his neck and was in a wheelchair for the last 4 years of his life, and I'd known him from being the POW.
Yeah,
and it's just amazing that we've gotten together, and we've been together now for about 8 years. And,
yeah, well, maybe that's the way life should be.
Sometimes you fall into it.
You know,
you have your ups and downs, and this was a big upper for us anyway.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, too. You know, I taught graduate students in college for quite a few years, and they were all master teachers. They were getting their master's degree in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question that I always ask my teachers was, what's the worst job you've ever had? And they came up with, you know, telemarketers, and I even got some jobs that I probably wouldn't even want to mention on the air. But my second question to them was, what did you learn from that? And I guess my point in that is, you know, my worst job was working in a mink farm. And the one thing that I learned from that was, I sure don't want to work in a mink farm the rest of my life. So even though you had some pretty awful experiences that most of us can't even come close to imagining, what did you learn from it? Did you learn resilience? Did you learn
patience? I learned to hang in there and get through that, and I think I have a very positive attitude. I don't look back. I don't even dream about it. So that doesn't. I've never had a dream about Vietnam.
Is that right?
And so I'm just fat. What was that? I better not say. I'm fat, dumb, and happy, as we say.
Well,
but I'm a very happy person, and I get along just fine with most everybody, and. Oh, about the Friday pilots, you asked
yes.
me about that. I'll get back to that for a second here. Anyway, when I got out of the air, when I got out of Vietnam, I came back and I went to the University of Arizona, got a master's degree in Latin American studies with the idea of going back down there as an air attaché or a mag chief. But as I was graduating from the U of A, the job as a professor of aerospace studies opened up, and I asked if I could just stay here and take that job, and they offered me the job. So I became a professor of aerospace studies for a couple years here at the University of Arizona, and then they wanted me to go to Central America as the air attaché for Central America, and Lori was going to be a senior in high school. And I had started playing around with little light airplanes, and so I got out of the Air Force and started an airplane business. So I had a businessman for about 5 years.
I think the fact that you became a professor and did all these other things would disprove your theory about fat, dumb, and happy, you know. So, and I'm glad that it. I'm glad that it did. So the Friday pilots, Lori said they get together every
Friday at.
I guess it would be Fridays, yes.
Friday pilots at a very nice hotel, very nice restaurant here in Tucson, Hacienda El Sol, and it started out. I'm the as the Navy called the plank holder, the first person to be in it. Because when we started with four of us, the other three guys have passed away. And so that started it. And then as one passed away, we got another one, and there's another one. And finally we formed, they're mostly Air Force people at the time. And then later on, now we have a Marine three-star general and a Marine colonel, couple Navy captains, a couple ex-helicopter pilots. We got an astronaut, Jim McDivitt, who's been coming for years.
Oh, really? Wow.
We've had a couple four-star generals, and we've had a couple lieutenants, the guys that got out. And we have one that's big lenses.
Oh,
well, he's big in something.
By the way, we've written two books.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's what Lori was saying. Lori was saying that I get a copy of it.
Well, I gave her a bunch of them here a while back. I don't know what she's done with them. She probably lost them.
Well, she actually was. When I got to the radio station, she was out in front selling them on the street. So,
she had to get a couple of dollars for them anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And, maybe I'll throw a few wings on my wheelchair and put a prop on the front, and I'll come down and join the Friday pilots. But
well, it's a great group, and we just have more fun. And with even the inter-service stuff goes on, you know, we kind of joke back and forth.
Before I just want also everybody to know again, remember that on this station here, we're talking to Rob Barnett, Colonel Barnett, who was a POW in Vietnam and he corrected me, a little over 6 years. And
1989 days. How's that?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you. I'll try and remember that. And I also hear, is it Suzanne? I hear in the background there.
Suzanne here.
Yeah. She's a good fiance because she gives advice. And if she ever asks you if she's giving too much advice, your answer is no, you're giving me just the right amount of advice.
And that's what I tell her.
Yes,
I do
that's
all the
good.
Time.
That's
she's,
good.
She's a princess, you know that.
Yes. And I assume that you also still have this full head of dark hair that I have in this veteran tribute.
Suzanne likes my hair.
Well, good, good. So there are so many many aspects to you, Bob. That's good. Well, let's talk to Lori a little bit, and because I'd Lori, when your dad left, you know, you were seven, so you remember that, I would assume,
I do remember.
And what were your thoughts at that time?
Well, everything was, I remember going to the airport. I remember we were saying goodbye. I don't know that the, you know, whole depth of the situation being seven. I just knew everybody was really sad. We're really sad to say goodbye, but it was always, we're going to be here a short time in the Los Angeles area. I was excited because I had some cousins I was going to get to be with and see grandma and grandpa. And, you know, so it felt good to be around. We have a great family, very close. So I think I was, you know, happy about that. That kind of diverted my attention.
And I think that's one thing true about kids. So, you know, when you're 7 years old, you know, you really don't understand consequences and probably the gravity of the fact that
what was happening,
that he's doing these 100 100 missions and bombing in a pretty dangerous area.
Right. That was probably over my head at the time, sure. You know, but I probably understood a little bit more than most seven-year-olds.
And, of course, you were in a military family, too.
Right. Had grown up in the military, so heard a lot of talk. I know my mom was really sad. We were all really sad, but had a lot of family around. So.
Yeah. And so... And did you must have had some communication with your dad during the time before he was.
I don't remember that at all. I don't remember that anything. I do remember the day though that I know he was gone, and then I remember walking home from school with a girlfriend, and I turned the corner of our block, and it was, you know, the middle of the afternoon, and I thought it was really odd. I could see that my aunt and uncle's car was there. I could see there were cars parked in front of our house that indicated there was a lot of family at the home, but I remember thinking, oh, that's really odd that they would all be there, but I was excited till I barreled in the door and found everybody in the living room on the couch crying. And that was my first, you know, then I was sat down, explained what happened, family was around, and that was kind of the first inkling of mm-hmm. anything. I don't know that I really understood everything, but everybody was pretty upset around me.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I'm 72. I'm just a youngster. But, you know, I remember back at, you know, when we would have something like that at our house where mm-hmm. you'd have relatives even that came over from Seattle. Or, you know, if we got a telephone call from relatives in Iowa,
right.
it wasn't just a chat kind of call,
right.
You know, it was something pretty serious. Bob, were you able to communicate with your family during that first? The months before you were shot down?
We were writing letters every day. And of course, my wife was writing me, and my brother wrote me letters, and my mother, and everybody. You know, we were always, you know, the mail was fine.
Yeah. What was, I was going to say, Lori, what was it, you know, during that time that he was missing, was it always a concern to you? And as you got older, did you understand the gravity of a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, I was an only child. So it was my mother and I living in the house. My grandmother, my mother's mother, lived with us as well. And, you know, like my dad had said, the first, you know, we did not know his status, just missing in action. My mother was very hardworking to just try and get information. She was just always fighting to get information and find out what we could. I don't remember that we ever thought anything other than he's listed as missing in action, but it's going to be okay. He's not. Maybe my mother had a premonition. I don't know. But
you're very hopeful.
Very,
like.
Very hopeful. And I think that was just always how it was in the household. I was probably more in tune to world events. You know, the TV was always on, and you know, I was probably a little bit more in tune to the Vietnam War than most kids my age. But it was really nice having the family all around me, and I was very close to my cousins and all. So we really spent a lot of time together. But it was always with talking about my father and, you know, looking at pictures. And I do remember when we finally found out that he was a prisoner of war. And, you know, that as bad as it sounds, we were just so happy and, you know, relieved to know that he was out there. So,
yeah, I can imagine. I mean, after thinking all those years, well, and not knowing, and then all of a sudden,
that you
don't know what, you know, necessarily what physical shape he's in or, you know, what he's been through, but you know that he's
alive.
He's alive, and that's
And I got to read the letter, I think, and my dad could correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the letters, and I think it was like the first one, was, and they were very small letters. They were like six lines. They could only be, you know, so much. It wasn't very much, but the whole letter was about me, and it was my birthday had been coming up, and, you know, he was thinking about that. And so that felt really special. That was good. That was good.
It's always good to know that other governments do prescribe how many lines you can have.
I guess because there's the Geneva Convention or whatever, wasn't there a certain number of, there was supposed to be certain correspondence that could be done that was supposed to be allowed, although that wasn't allowed and that wasn't something that happened, but very sporadically later on when it did. It was
And Bob, how did you decide what was going to go on those six lines?
Well, you couldn't write anything negative, and mainly I just wanted to tell him that I was doing okay and don't worry about me, and I'm thinking about them.
I guess you could say you got room service.
And actually we used our letters to also write some secret things.
Right. I remember that birthday letter. I remember even as a young kid just reading it and thinking that it was talking about my birthday and a birthday cake, but the wording was really odd. And then years later, I found out that, you know, I guess that was some secret coding or whatever. But
really?
I was thrilled that it was my birthday. It was about my birthday.
I know that there was... this always struck me. There was one POW that I can't even remember the guy's name, but I remember seeing this on TV and that he was being interrogated and he was one that was brought in front of the cameras and, you know, and was, you know, forced to say all these things, you know, positive things and Americans were bad and all that stuff. And that he was blinking his eyes using...
using the Morse code, Denton.
Yeah.
That was Admiral Denton.
Now, that's okay to do, right? I mean, that's...
Well, that's the only thing, you resist the most you can. And they worked him over so badly. He came back and became a senator from Alabama.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's cool. How about when you came back, what was the process of you transitioning? Did they take you to, did they just tell you right away, or did they, that work?
The Air Force did a great job. When we left Hanoi, we flew to Clark Air Base in the Philippines, and we were there for 3 days, and of course got debriefed and got to take a warm shower and flush toilets and drink milk and have ice cream and eat meat. And they opened the BX one night just for us, so we went over and bought things for our families and stuff. They outfit us in our uniforms, and then we flew from Clark Air Force Base. In my case, I flew into March Air Force Base in California, and that's where I met, I don't know if Lori gave you that picture or not, but I sent her a picture of, just as I got off the airplane, Anita and Lori and I were hugging.
I didn't see that. I would love to see that. Yeah.
That's a great, as he got off the airplane, we were all standing there and we got to rush over and, you know, see him for the first time. Hug him for the first time.
Touch him, yeah.
I remember that he called before he got to March Air Force.
Yeah,
there was one night.
Call from the Philippines.
Right, and I got to talk to him on the phone, and I was like, oh, hello.
What do you say?
I don't really remember what I said. Yeah. Just, oh, hello. But, then March 17th, we still celebrate that day. It's St. Patrick's Day, but it also is a big day because that's when he flew to March Air Force Base, and we finally got to see him.
Yeah.
So.
Uh-huh. And everybody was kind of wondering what you'd be like. And when I got off the airplane at Clark Air Force Base, there was a bus there, and I was walking over towards the bus, and the guys in the bus were saying, some of my friends here at the station in the Philippines had a big sign, "Welcome home, Bob Barnett." Anyway, I got it close to the bus, and the TV cameras were taking pictures of everything. And all the guys at the bus were saying, "There's a sign over there. Look at it." And so anyway, I walked towards the bus, and I turned around, and I looked. I was trying to look for the sign, and my wife Anita was looking, and she said, "God, he doesn't know how to get on the bus."
Yeah. Well, and you have picked up that skill since then, is that correct?
Well, yeah. I did get on the bus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, as long as you didn't miss the bus. That was the key.
We don't miss any buses anymore.
You know, Bob, that must have been, just explain to me, I mean, being able to, you know, to be in that horrible situation for those years and to then actually realize you're in America and there's your family coming towards you, that has got to be a picture in your mind that you could never forget.
I just wish I could redo that moment over and over.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Just everything, you know, over there, everything was gray and ugly. And then all once, the American red flag and the blues and all the colors and magnified everything like that.
One of the questions, I came from a small town and, little town called Ellensburg, a little cowboy town.
Yeah, and that's where my grandson's going to school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. I think Laurie told me that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it's a party town, too. So
you better not be doing too much.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I grew up there, and my mom was, she was in charge of all the veterans coming back from Vietnam, transitioning into school and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for the most part, my friends that were, I would say there were 30 people out of my graduating class that went into Vietnam, 30 men. And for the most of them, they had it was a small community, fairly conservative community. They seemed to do pretty well, getting back into society. How were you treated when you came back?
We were very lucky. You know, a lot of the vets came back, and the anti-war people would spit on them and throw things at the airports at them. And in fact, I think the military was saying put on civilian clothes. It got so bad. Of course, I didn't have any of that. They used to show us movies of all the anti-war stuff, and stuff like that. Anyway, when I got home, I think everybody was so happy to get the POWs out of there that we went to the White House. I went to met governors. I had dinner with Ronald Reagan. We went to parades. And then the Air Force did, like I said, I wanted to go to the University of Arizona, and they said, okay. Then we had a program where we all went down to Maxwell Air Force Base, what we call to get re-blued, and they had a program that lasts about 2 weeks where they had all the news from the previous 5 or 6 years, and we had astronauts come talk to us and everything.
Wow,
so they just went overboard to get us back. And I, of course, I always felt that going over there was a hell of a lot harder than coming back this way. Yeah.
It's interesting because, you do hear the different stories, and I do hear how people, have transitioned, and some have done better than others. I've had lots of friends that have done very, very well coming back, and some that have had, more difficulties.
Well, a lot of guys came home, their families were all broken up, and went through a lot of stuff that way. And it's amazing, as far as I know, we've only had two suicides of the ex-POWs, and two of them came early on.
Mm-hmm.
One was an Air Force person, and his wife had left him, and I guess he was very depressed.
Sure.
And he's the only one. One later on, much later on, he had some medical problems, and he took his life. But of of all the, that's the only ones I've known, a whole group that, you know, did that.
Well, you know,
now we had a couple that went, you know, got drinking, and but for the most part, they, most of the guys have done very, very well.
Well, I think that's important, and I think it probably helped too that the, you know, and there were other people in your situation in that prison, you know.
Yeah, we were very supportive of each other. We still stay in contact with each other.
I think your granddaughter is here banging. Is that your okay? She's banging
pictures.
On the window,
she's
but we're not.
She's
taking pictures.
Yes,
I think she can hear us outside, so we're going to let her in and let her take a picture of your daughter. And I really appreciate you doing this. I'm actually thinking about getting a home down in Green Valley, which I guess is fairly close.
Very close.
Claire's down there. Yeah,
in fact, Lori has some very good friends.
I have some friends that just moved there.
Yeah.
Right. You'd like it there. Very nice.
And I think that I really have to thank Suzanne for something, too. And that's the fact that I know in another 20 years, my hair will still be beautiful, too. So, you know, that's something that's really good. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to say in kind of in closing? We've got 2 minutes here. Let's see if you have anything to say, Bob, and then let's ask Lori if she, what she would like to say. That gives her some time to think about it.
Mostly, like I can say that I am so grateful that I survived. Because if I did not, there would not be any McCartney. There wouldn't be any Jordan who's trying to get in the door.
Uh-huh.
There wouldn't be any Casey. There wouldn't be any
McKenzie.
So that was the main thing. If I hadn't survived, everything would have been different. I don't know where Lori would have ended up. She wouldn't end up in Seattle. She'd been somewhere else.
Sure.
And they'd never come to Tucson to begin with.
You'd probably like them to come down there again real soon, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're coming next week. So, but I
all
mean,
right.
our lives would have been just completely different.
Very different.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. That's my main thought.
Any thoughts from you, Lori?
I'm grateful that there's this opportunity as time goes on. I am grateful that we're capturing these stories and hearing them. It's a good legacy for my children and my grandchildren to hear and know what their grandfather has done. So I'm really grateful for these opportunities. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. And when I get down there to visit, I'm stopping by, Bob. I'm going to be my own judge on how beautiful your hair is.
I'll take you to the Hacienda del Sol.
All right.
And meet the Friday Pilots.
We'll do it. Thank you very much, and we are out of here. And thank
bye-bye.
You, Lori. Thank you, Bob.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.